absolutely nothing. Say it again, y'all.
Whoa.
Look out.
What is it good for?
Absolutely
nothing.
Listen to me.
Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now.
We are live.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm talking about Jimmy on the board. S&P futures down 81. NASDAQ futures down 384. So let's say the president's speech bombed in terms of the market anyway. Oil up $8, 108.38. We've got everything else pretty much in the crapo. We've got gold down 100 and some points. We've got, you know, all kinds of stuff, 100 and some dollars. We have Professor Liu.
Good morning, sir.
How are you, bud?
I'm good.
Are you short spooze?
Great song. Great song choice. I love that song.
Are you short spooze?
Short spood, no, but...
Spooze. S-P-U-S. Spooze.
I have no idea what that is.
S&P futures.
Oh. One of these days, I'm gonna lapse into military acronym jargon.
Well, yeah, well, that'd be cool. Actually, what you'd be short now wouldn't be the spoos; it'd be the sperms. The SBMs, the Junes.
Which goes back to my long-standing comment about your mouse pad that I thought was describing sex acts when it was actually describing market strategies. Anyway,
you're the only guy I know that probably has the unabridged version of the Kama Sutra, just so you can get a few pointers.
No, I'm not that flexible anymore, Tom.
I was going to say, if I was you, even though you're in really pretty good shape, I wouldn't try half of the stuff.
There are lots of things, as I understand it, from just the illustrations that, you know, people my age, our age, shouldn't attempt out of fear of injury.
I'm not so sure that people haven't practiced yoga their entire life when trying that stuff. But anyway, the only people who can do that are people that are in the what's the name of that? Not a dance troupe, Cirque du Soleil people. They're the only people I ever saw that could do stuff like that.
Or looked like they did.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm sorry I missed last week, and I'm gonna, be gone a couple of weeks. But
next week you're out, or is the week after?
I'm sorry.
Next week you're out, or is it the week after?
It's both.
Oh, the next 2 weeks. Okay.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
How the hell do you
calendar is not cooperating.
It's like replacing Pavarotti, for God's sake. How the hell do you do that?
No, it's not. I thought you guys did it. I heard part of the show last week. I thought you guys were terrific, and I said, "Oh, don't miss a beat."
Hey, I have to ask you. You and I have been talking about, and I have not heard this on TV, but of course, I'm stumbling through YouTube looking for a basketball highlight. They're talking about they got this new plane, not a new plane that you and I like, just like you and I have talked about, some propeller job they've taken from a trainer. Souped it up, and it's like a drone fighter. The thing looks awesome. Would you say? What is that?
So the Air Force had been looking for a counterinsurgency aircraft, and COIN aircraft. Here I go with my acronyms. COIN assets are usually cheaper, off the shelf type stuff that can be readily adapted to other missions. So essentially what they did is they went to a couple of aircraft manufacturers and said, well, here's what we want. We want something that is relatively cheap, something relatively easy to fly in the sense that we'll be able to train second and third world pilots on it. So that was, we don't have to have a long training pipeline or as long a training pipeline. It has it's called loiter capability, which means it can stay up for a while without having to be refueled. So
it's
you're
like
talking
3.5-4 hours, this thing.
Yeah. You're talking about something typically, now you're talking about a prop aircraft. It's gotta be able to we could hang, missiles on it, hang weapons on it. So the winner was this, I can't remember who the name of the manufacturer, Air Tractor or somebody like that. But, basically it looks like a modified crop duster. But it's armored.
Fast. It looks smooth. I mean, it looks really sleek.
If it's the thing I'm thinking of, it's a prop aircraft.
Yeah, but it goes 350 miles an hour.
Yeah, it's a one-seater.
Yeah. Not sure, because I thought it was from a trainer. I thought it had two seats. Whatever,
could be the trainer version of it. In any event, they've let this contract, and you end up with an aircraft that looks a little bit like a general aviation, basic general aviation aircraft, but that can stay up for a while, and it's souped up. It's got some bells and whistles on it that give it capability that a normal aircraft of that type wouldn't even dream of. And yeah, it can orbit over a base or over an area when they detect drones have been fired. So what you're seeing is a reaction. Air defense, air attack is a chess game. Move, counter move. So the move is the drones. These slow flying drones that are relatively inexpensive. You can launch hundreds of them and saturate.
Compared to a Blackbird, yeah, it's slow, but 350 isn't all that slow.
Well, but I mean, I'm sorry, the drones are relatively slow.
Yeah, this thing's way faster than they are.
They're 200, yeah. They're 150, 200, maybe 250. They're jet powered ones, but they're not fast, and they're simple and basic, and they've got a relatively, they've got a small charge on them, but enough to do damage. So you can make hundreds of these things. So now they're designed to saturate air defenses, which were mainly focused on dealing with high-value aircraft or bombs coming in. So now the counter move is we got to come up with something cheap to deal with this. The Israelis have one version in their iron beam system, which is essentially a laser that can target mortar shells, artillery shells, and slow-moving drones. Another variation is some of the stuff that the Ukrainians have been doing, which is, and Ukraine really has been the experimental testbed for a lot of this. So in Ukraine, you see everything from guys with shotguns to 50 caliber machine guns to high technology, all aimed by people, by the way, to high technology systems like Rheinmetall's cannon system, which is basically a souped up high fast firing any aircraft gun that fires 30 millimeter shells that are designed to take down drones. All of these are much cheaper alternatives than shooting $200,000-$300,000 missiles at these things. The Iranians have also developed what are called counter drones, which are relatively cheap, small, optically guided drones that are autonomous, that they can launch, basically point at the area of the sky where an incoming drone is flying, and these things will take off and fly and intercept them on their own. That may be the ultimate in counter technology.
Well, this thing had I was wishing you were here on the phone with me, because I think the thing has some machine gun. It's got a cannon that blows up like a grenade. It's got like five different armaments on it.
Yeah, and they can equip it with, so again, going back to simpler systems, I think the rockets are called Hydra rockets. They're basically 2.75-inch unguided rockets that we've been firing since World War II. They come in, pods with 50 or 60 of these rockets in a pod, but they're unguided, and the idea was you would fire a salvo of these things at a target and they'd hit something. Well, somebody had the bright idea of putting a laser guidance system on these things. It's relatively cheap, and once you put a laser guidance on them, they'll hit within 2 inches of wherever you're aiming, and so they're perfect for dealing with drones if you're an airborne target, or you're an airborne platform. You can fly along, you see the drone, your target designation system picks it up, lights it up with a laser, and once you've told the system to track this thing, it'll track it. It keeps the laser on the target, and then you release one of these rockets and knock it down for a cost of less than half the actual cost it takes to produce the drone. So these are the kind, and that can be fitted on these counterinsurgency aircraft easily. It's perfect for that.
It's interesting, Lou. And by the way, guys like you that always are dealing with finished products. I always shudder when somebody says, "Well, you can make hundreds of these things." Coming from somewhat of a manufacturing background at Pullman, granted, a drone is not a railroad car, but if you tell me you want me to produce 500 of something, there's got to be 100 parts in the thing. Some maybe are available at the hardware store, but most probably aren't. To get all that together in one place, to have people assemble it, even if it's not, we're not talking about an F-16, nothing's easy when you're doing that. I mean, because the thing doesn't have five parts, it's probably got 500 or 150 in there. I mean, the idea that anybody can open up a warehouse and start popping drones out the back end, I don't know about that necessarily.
Let me just say that is pretty close to what happened in Ukraine when the Russians started launching these mass drone attacks. The Ukrainians, it started with basically equipping off-the-shelf drones like the one I have in my office.
Yeah, it starts there.
With a hand grenade or an artillery shell. And they literally began manufacturing these things on their own. And it was kind of a garage, garage operation. I understand what you're saying. Notably, when you say, any manufacturing operation is difficult, that's what Anduril and a number of these other high-technology manufacturing operations that are focused on defense products, that's what they're doing. They're taking, because they're using 3D printing and other modernized technologies, what they're doing is they're basically saying we can reduce the time it takes to make one of these things to a very low number. We can produce them at scale because we're using machines to produce them, not people. And once we train one machine, once we write a line of code or lines of code that give us the ability to 3D print a circuit board or 3D print a wing or an engine, once we do it for one machine, we've done it for 10,000. And so we can suddenly scale this up in a hurry. And that's, you're exactly right. This is not, I don't want to sound like it's just making, you know, you wave your magic wand and these drones appear. But we, our manufacturing people have stepped up the capability to produce all kinds of things. And these kinds of systems are examples.
We're really good at this. I mean, Lou, what did the first livery ship took 340 days and the last one took 30 days? I mean, we're good at this. But still, you need, you know, I'm not, you know, boy, when it comes to this high-end stuff, I'm not the dude, but when you start talking about it can look ahead, well, wait a minute. Now you need chips. Now you need something. Where do you get the chips from? They're not coming from the farm in Ukraine. They're coming from China or Taiwan or here or some damn place.
Or they're repurposing. Okay, they're stuff.
My point is, every one of the things, you're absolutely correct, like you usually are. You're absolutely correct that every one of them has a solution. But if there's 100 parts, that's 100 solutions. And some of them are coming from someplace. And you're going to find one bolt in the damn thing that you can't get at the hardware store. it inevitably happens, right?
And that's so this is what I was doing when I was in Italy. This is the kind of role that the company I was working for and set up was doing in Italy. We were taking those kinds of hard to replicate parts and essentially designing them so that they could be produced by 3D printing.
Was that a success? I mean, I don't talk about the company, but the system.
We were on the road until COVID basically shut us down.
Right. But I mean, did the 3D, was it all you expected of it, more or less?
It was everything I expected in terms of ability to replicate, in terms of ability to produce spare parts or new or old items in new ways, ways that were designed differently, that were lighter, stronger, with better material. It met my expectations in that regard. The main issue with a 3D printing system is it's still pretty slow, and it can be expensive. You have to be able to do it at scale to make it cost effective. But if you're repairing a fleet of 60 or 100 airplanes, which is what we were talking about with a lot of the old Warsaw Pact equipment, you know, making 60 parts or even 100 parts becomes less of an issue when you're producing it for those kinds of specialized applications. So the cost is an issue, but with scaling your setup so that you have enough machines working, you know, full time, you can drive that down. Otherwise, yeah, the capabilities of 3D printing are spectacular.
Well, it's how much different is it than I know a little bit about metalwork, but it's been so long. Of course, they didn't have computer stuff in those days, but you can give guys, and they used to call them, every place like Pullman had what they call a blacksmith shop. You could pretty much give them a drawing of anything, and those dudes would make it. You know, it might take them 2-3 days to come up with one of them. I mean, but they're pretty good at grinding and lathes and all kinds of stuff. And now you can move forward into, you can pretty much put any dimensions and any hunk of metal into one of those computerized things, and the thing will slit it, it'll grind it, it'll drill it, but it takes a real long time. And then, of course, if you want 50 parts, then you have to have some kind of a line where one guy slits it, one guy does something else, one guy does something else. But how much different is 3D printing than having one of those computerized machines that just take a piece of metal and flip it every which way but sideways and work on it for half a day until finally you get what you want.
Yeah, it's they're called CMC machines,
right?
Computer milling something. Yeah, those are great, but there are a lot of things that you can do. Or 3D printing technology gives you the capability to do things with metal and ceramic composites and alloys that you can't do either by forging, milling,
okay,
molding.
Fair enough.
You can't. So for example, and I may have given you this on the air, you have a rocket motor nozzle for an air-to-air missile. All right, that nozzle has to be able to withstand incredible temperatures because of the missile exhaust burning through it. Typically, it's going to be made, let's say, out of a steel tungsten kind of alloy that's extremely dense and very heavy. A 3D printing nozzle, you can replicate and build that nozzle using a 3D printer, but you can really print it with filaments, little tubes that run through the nozzle, and,
okay,
and you can cut it so that literally what you end up with is a nozzle that is almost honeycombed with these filaments, and
almost like a fiber optic sort of.
Yeah, and except you can't make it. I mean, they're pretty fine, they're small, and then through that tube, you can run a coolant. You can either run liquid fuel from the missile itself or some other kind of small coolant that you can put in there. It only has to cool it for a flight, you know, for a flight time of, you know, a burn time of, you know, 30, 40 seconds. And now that nozzle, because it's being cooled, it doesn't have to be able to withstand temperatures of 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Now it can maybe withstand temperatures of 50. It only has to be able to withstand temperatures of 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit because the coolant basically reduces the temperature of the rocket exhaust that's affecting the metal. When you do that, you can cut the weight by 40 to 50%.
Whoa.
And a 40 to 50% weight reduction in an air-to-air missile on something like that makes a big difference in terms of...
So we're talking 30 pounds down to 15, or are we talking, I mean, how heavy, yeah, how heavy was the first iteration?
Well, I mean, the variation that I saw cut its weight from, I don't know, whatever it was, 25, 30 pounds, like you said, down to something, well, in the low, hey, double digits.
Hey, I saw the Artemis thing take off. Do they have solid fuel rockets strapped to that thing?
Yes, they do.
I thought those things, since the shuttle blew up, we were never going to use those again.
We used them in subsequent shuttle launches, and we've been using them.
I know, but
them
I thought that was the major design flaw of the shuttle, that it was...
They were problematic, but part of the issue, the reason the Artemis has been having such technical issues is because NASA was directed by Congress to use up the spare shuttle stuff that they had. So I think those solid boosters are actually repurposed shuttle boosters.
Well, the reason why those things are so dangerous is once you light them, you can't turn them off.
Well, that's right. They're not scalable, and so we haven't, you know, we haven't been using solid rockets for our manned flights for a while until the shuttle came along. But yeah, those are solid strap-on boosters that give you that extra bit of oomph to clear the.
Well, you know, when the
it was a very impressive launch. But I understand that their toilet is broken.
One of like three or something. But you can go back to the manual ones or something, whatever that means.
Yeah, there's a manual system, but the automatic toilet's no good.
Don't you hate it when that happens?
How would you like to be on a 10-day mission and you're in space? It's not like you just, okay, I want you to hold it until the next meeting,
yeah,
the next oasis on the tollway.
Yeah, I know.
You're in space. You know, this is it, baby.
I don't know. You probably, maybe the only one of the people listening or contributing this morning, I took a course at Notre Dame called Space Tech and Society, and it was for the people in aerospace. It was kind of a history of the, you know, of their subject, and, you know, it was a course for guys in aerospace who they basically beat the crap out of. It's a real tough major, as you obviously know.
Oh yeah, I took two semesters of astronautical engineering when I was an undergrad. It was a nightmare.
My mother's cousin, one of my best friends, went to Ohio State. It's a 5-year major at Ohio State. not even four, but in Notre Dame, they chose to beat people up for 4 years. But there was this course, Space Tech, which was like for those guys. It was a no-brainer A course, right? But they originally got to develop paper airplanes and fly them off the balcony in Washington Hall and stuff. It was all about, you know, early flight and so forth. And sort of like the engineering school had a engineering morality class where you could go and be 10 people sitting there and everybody got an A type of thing. It was like every really tough major had a class like that. Anyway, everybody finds out about this Space Tech. So like the entire school starts taking it because they know you got an A if you just showed up once in a while. And
well, you get to make paper airplanes.
Well, no, it got so many people in there that they stopped doing the paper airplanes and the kites because there was now there's 100 people. Anyway, I'm one of the few guys that actually went to class. Everybody else just stole notes from people. And I thought it was one of the most fascinating classes I was ever in. The guy, they had three teachers, one of whom was a former head of NASA. There was another guy who was almost as... I don't think I've ever had... every one of those classes, I couldn't wait to get to. Meanwhile, everybody else doesn't want to go. They just want their A. But this is 1974. The dude is talking about the space shuttle. And he was very upset. The original design of the space shuttle was supposed to be some huge, essentially, plane, you know, bigger than a 747 or whatever, to carry the shuttle up to like 50,000 feet. And then he would drop the shuttle would take off, and this thing would land, and then the shuttle would land. They wanted no part of what the shuttle ended up being with the solid fuel stuff, because they thought then that was too dangerous. So we want essentially a big plane to fly the shuttle without the stuff on the side up to however high we can get it. We're going to drop it, the shuttle takes off, and it makes into orbit from there, and they both come home. They wanted no part of those solid fuel things that ended up blowing the thing up the one time, right? I mean, and then he said, because of the money, they're going to cut back to the other. And the guy said, one day, I remember this, like it was yesterday, the guy goes, I'll bet by the time this thing is done, with the extra expense of the basically half-ass way to do it, which is the way he described it, there'll be some casualties and it'll end up costing more than if we did it right from the first place. I remember that lecture like it was yesterday. It'll end up costing us more than if we just did it right in the first place.
So I mean, for many years, and it may still be true, I don't know if something supplanted it, but for many years, the most dangerous job in the United States was an astronaut.
Oh yeah, well, why not? Yeah.
In terms of risk and bad outcomes.
Well, you had 12 people die out of 100, so that's a lot.
A relatively small number of actual job days versus, you know, fatalities.
Well, who died? It was the people in the fire in Florida, and then two shuttle groups, right?
We had two shuttles go down. We had the
fire Wally Schirra.
Apollo 1 fire. I think that was it. But yeah,
and none of the Mercury, none of those people, they were all okay.
No, they got close.
Yeah,
but, So it was just. I may have mentioned this last summer. I had the opportunity to go through the Udvar Hazy Air and Space Museum in near Dulles Airport. So that is the big hangar for the National Air and Space Museum sort of annex. And
that's where they brought all the big stuff that they couldn't bring on the mall, right?
Stuff they couldn't put in the mall. Yeah. So you know, where in the mall they had the cockpit of the Enola Gay B-29 bomber. At this museum they've got the whole aircraft. It's assembled and sitting there. And I had the chance to go through that. They have a full size space shuttle. They have a space shuttle there, you know, just parked in the parked in the hangar. I had the chance to go through there with one of my classmates who is an astronaut, Tom Jones. He's appeared on any number of news shows about space flight, and he may have been. He probably was interviewed yesterday for the Artemis flight. But Tom walked us through this thing, and it's, you know, it's fascinating to get with an astronaut standing in front of a shuttle that he actually flew. And so he's talking to us about how certain aspects of the shuttle were sort of jury-rigged. And I went, what do you mean? And he goes, well, like, look at this hatch under here. So there's a hatch on the underside of the shuttle in the, you know, in the area where they've got those tiles for recovery. You know, it's this heat shield area. But there's a hatch there. And that hatch opens up or has to be able to, it opens up or just before takeoff. And it, anyway, somebody at some point in the training was looking at it going, okay, well, this thing opens up, we open it up in flight. What if we can't close it? What if the automatic system to shut the door doesn't work?
I'm thinking they're screwed.
well, it has to close. They can't land. They can't come back into the atmosphere with this thing open because they'll burn up. It'll be like what happened with Columbia. So I said, so what do you do? I mean, you got a backup motor, I assume, or something, or some crawl space inside the shuttle where somebody could crawl down in there and pull a rope or something. And he goes, nope. You have to close it. If we had to close it, we had to go EVA. And I said, okay. There are no handholds down here. You don't have a maneuvering, on most of your missions, you don't have a maneuvering unit that you can just step out into space and fly around. What do you do? And he said, we had to throw a rope, a nylon rope, and we had to figure out a way to get it out of the shuttle bay, because we get to the shuttle bay on the upper part of the aircraft. We had to figure out a way to get a rope out of the shuttle bay and around the wing and underneath the shuttle into this area so that there would be a way to secure the astronaut climbing, basically climbing hand over hand out of the shuttle bay. And I said, all right, what, somebody has to throw that out there? He said, yeah, but we needed a weight at the end of it so it would swing around, you know, something that would give the rope some heft and some mass so that it would actually, when we threw it out, it would actually, we could maneuver the shuttle and roll it around there. And it would go to the end of the rope and then it would fold itself back under because of the weight at the end.
There's no gravity, so it's just that would be
right. No, you got everything's got to have, you got to be a matter of mass rather than weight. And then Tom said, so what they had us do was take one of our laundry bags for our dirty clothes, and we would stuff the laundry bag with as many dirty clothes as we could put in there, and then we would tie the rope around the end of the laundry bag, and that was our weight. We would climb out into the shuttle bay area and twirl this thing over our heads like a lasso, and then throw it, and the weight on the end of the bag would pull it under. And I said, so the repair is reduced to a laundry bag. He said, yep.
Well, remember, was it Apollo 13, all the stuff that they piled in the middle of the room, they said, make me a carbon scrubber or whatever?
Yeah, but that was the result of an explosion.
Yeah.
This is the result of somebody just saying, you know, we can only build so much redundancy into the system. But I told him, I said, you know, we always assume that the redundancy in these systems, if you couldn't build it, make everything redundant, but key stuff like a hatch on the underside of the shuttle on the heat shield that absolutely has to close, you thought that they would reduce or they would make that a redundant system, but apparently not. And I said, I would have paid money. Now, you know, it's terrifying because it means the people in the shuttle are going to die if they don't get it fixed. But I would have paid money to have a video of some astronaut, you know, highly trained, you know, PhD and whatever, with a laundry bag out in the shuttle bay at the end of a rope trying to throw this thing around the corner. And Tom just laughed. He said, yeah, I said, did you ever practice that? He said, no, it was just in the procedures. But
well, remember in Star Wars, what was the big weakness? The garbage chute.
Yeah. You're not supposed to design it that way. So anyway, that's just to give you an idea of how no matter how complicated we think this stuff is, you still had to rely on basic, you know, monkey brain kind of solutions to some of these issues.
Okay.
Anyway, that's a.
Can I shift? I want to talk a little bit about some of the sports stuff, but can I shift gears for just a bit? Regardless, you know, whatever the war is doing, you know, the war is doing. I can't help, Lou, since I, you know, I was very young, but I went through it. Try and make to have some parallels between this, what we're doing, and Vietnam.
The buildup in Vietnam.
Well, but I'm trying to tie together the economy and how people paid for it versus now. To me, it's like I can't believe I ran this by a couple people last weekend that I think are pretty bright, and they go, you know, I can't argue with you at all on this one. I just hope we don't go there. But we had before the president's speech last night. Now we're down 101 in the SPOOs and 470 in the Nasdaq, so it wasn't received very well. But everybody was on TV yesterday. All the, you know, pontificators,
all the Gulf War experts that have suddenly materialized,
yeah,
right?
Well, but they're also market people. In a couple of weeks, we're going to be back to normal. Don't worry, the market's going to keep going up like it always has. We're going to be back to quote normal. And I'm sitting there going, define normal, bub. what is normal these days? I don't. And I hearken back to my Vietnam memories, and I'm doing a little research this morning. The things that are the same are men of enormous egos lighting on a mission without really knowing what the end of the mission is. And every time the other guy fights back, they get more pissed off that it's not over, and they accelerate the process. And also, in the midst of trying to find somebody to negotiate with to kick their ass and have it be over, we essentially did a regime change by knocking people off. Same thing we did in Vietnam. We kicked the guy out, right? I mean, they're not...
Well, we didn't... No, we didn't do that in Vietnam. We didn't attack the leadership in North Vietnam.
No, but I'm saying...
We took the leadership out in South Vietnam.
That's what I'm talking about. So they were supposedly our allies. I'm just saying it's not a perfect parallel. But the thing that I think investors... And I don't know the outcome, Lou. If I did, I'd be, you know... I'd be flying around in a private jet. But we don't have any money. Same thing as we sort of did back then. And we decided at Bretton Woods in 68 to go off the gold standard so we could borrow a lot of, essentially put money into the system to pay for the Vietnam War, which caused an inflation that really lasted 14 years and changed this entire society to this day. And now we're doing the exact same thing. This guy, and with his... And I will never understand in my grave, Lou, why the guy can't stand Powell. Powell has done exactly what he wants him to do. Pours money into our money supply is creeping up, is expanding to meet the demand. There's no way this guy's taxing more. He's going to put out more taxes, and we're trying to borrow more. But he's insulting the hell out of the people that we borrow the money from, which is bizarre. But we're printing money last month, and people that maybe are younger than me, or all they want to do is you send them money and they put it in the market and they want their 1% and it goes up. I'm looking at a chart of the Dow. Okay, we touched 1,000 in November of 1972. We had made like 980 something in 70. Where the hell am I at here? We were 937 and 69, but basically it was 72. The Dow crept through 1,000. Iteration, a couple times it got back there. We got 999 in March of 76. We did not go through 1,000 to stay until, I'm going to say, 1982. So we're talking 11 years with no return. And in the meantime, it traded as low as like 815. So it went down 20. No, wait, the low tick was here. In 1974, 618, we were down 40% as this inflation started up. Interest rates started going up because the government, to borrow more money, you got to pay more interest, right? Duh. This was a 14-year fiasco started by people wandering into a war not thinking it was going to last very long. Said that's no problem. We'll just print the money to pay for it. Then it kept lasting longer and longer because every time the other side did something, all those bastards, they're accelerating, so we got to accelerate. It took forever, and it absolutely changed the history of this country. It changed families. It changed the way people think about investing for a long time. We're going right down the same road, Lou. What the hell?
Why do you have to reach back to Vietnam to do that when we have...
Well, because it was a 14-year phenomenon. If you were to tell people in the market right now, after Bozo on TV talks about you just got to be in the market for the long run, we're talking 14 years to break even. And at one point, you're down 40%. And, oh, by the way, if you're in the bank, you're making 9%. You think that's a successful investment?
So there are a couple of different ways of looking at this from a perspective of a non-investment guy, and that's me.
Okay. Well, actually, Lou, even if it's under your mattress, you're an investor. You might not be a good one, but you are one.
Well, okay, but let me strike that then, and let me rephrase it from the perspective of an ignorant investor. All right, because that would be me. I'm looking at this going, we've heard the toxin about sounding about inflation and government spending for a long time. The only place where I've really seen that play out directly was what happened when we pumped $6 trillion into the economy over COVID and in the COVID spending period that came in from 20 to 24.
Well, that was a 40% increase in money supply. That'll get anybody's attention, even somebody who says he's a bad investor.
But it didn't wreck the economy. This war
it didn't wreck your economy.
Well, it didn't. I watch what's going on around me. I mean, we didn't have food riots. We didn't have a veterans army down on the mall. We didn't have we didn't shut the people. I don't see a bunch of people taking mass transit because they can't afford gasoline. It didn't have that effect. So, and then I look at the cost of the fight so far, and $200 billion, which is not chump change, but then again, this is an ignorant investor. Then I think back. You know what? We dumped $2 trillion in the last administration into something that was supposed to do infrastructure repair.
It has done a lot of it.
Well, we dumped that in there, so we're with no explosive effect. And so I'm thinking, all right, $200 billion is a tenth of $2 trillion, and I'm not going to get too concerned about it yet.
Okay, but that's just. We're starting from a different place, though, in 68.
Could be. That's what I remember. Yeah. Remember, I'm an ignorant investor.
No. I mean, there's been two. You're gonna point to the Democratic one. There's been two.
I'm just saying now,
in the last, before this started, two things happened.
Irrespective of whether that $2 trillion did anything or not, I don't think it did. But never mind. I don't care about that. I just from a comparison perspective, I'm thinking. We put $2 trillion into domestics. I didn't see a blow up. So,
trust me on this one. There's a huge blow up. But it's water torture. It's trickling at people. I've been,
and that's why, as I said,
it's been happening since 2000, really since 2008, where the growth of the money supply and the growth of inflation. That's being lied to us since then. It's not just all Trump. Has exceeded people's ability to earn. It's been glossed over by the amount of fixed assets, meaning stocks and houses, going up. So people's wealth has increased. But even if you look at somebody who's making $150 a year, and if you were to say to the guy, forget your 401k, forget your IRA, forget the fact that your house is going up, and let's say he's a renter. You think for a second he's keeping pace?
Yeah, I get it, but again, I don't see it hammering.
Hammering is a wrong term. It's it, it hammers people sort of individual. Simple. One of the things that's not in the CPI, and, you know, I do this stuff just, you know, for the show because I like doing it, and I like to bring something to the table because you guys all do, you know, stuff I don't, so I like to bring some stuff here maybe that the other people don't know. I've been railing on the CPI for forever, right? And I did one of my studies. I went through it. I was very sloppy. I said, you know, the cost of primary education, meaning, which is usually done through taxes, at least here in Illinois it is, property taxes, mostly, or some, you know, some contribution from the state, but mostly property taxes. And I had it from 2000 to 2020 up almost three times when the CPI was up 1.8, right? So it's way higher. And now Maria Pappas, who I think is somewhat of a decent, she's the, what's she, Jimmy, the county assessor or something? I don't know. But she came out and said, for the last 30 years, property taxes in Illinois have been double the published rate of inflation. So mm-hmm. It wasn't just me doing it. You know, somebody actually came out and confirmed it. And I would say Larissa was on yesterday talking about how your insurance, meaning, you know, medical stuff that people pay for, even if you're being charitable and you think the plans aren't the same as they were 20 years ago because individuals have more deductibles and that kind of crap, that's up like three times too. So there's all these little things, Lou, and what I've noticed kind of lately, and maybe, you know, maybe you haven't, Audrey was telling me that, you know, somebody was going for this, some test, a medical test, and the doctor said, hey, you know, just pay for it. It's only like $60. Well, person went there and they said, well, it was $60 in December, now it's $120. Okay. We're not talking about it's now $65. You know, and I doing some work on my truck, I was gonna get some Bilstein shocks last year. They were $75, now they're $90. They're not $77, they're not $78. They're like $90. I mean, we're seeing jumps in places you don't even, you know, the air conditioner. Yeah. I mean,
I get that. I understand that. My point is that what you're talking about requires a longer term view than the average ignorant investor has, and that's why I say when I compare this to the other stuff that we've thrown money at.
Well, let's be fair. We've had, when we'll talk about Trump today, Trump won and Biden, probably the worst 8 years of presidency combined we'll ever see. In Trump's first term, he puts through this huge tax decrease, right? With the lie that the decrease in taxes for rich people is going to somehow make everybody more industrious, and we'll end up with higher receipts than we would have otherwise. Which, I'll tell you what, Lou, I've done a lot of tax study. That's bullshit. And then we get Joe Biden comes in, and he puts through this, like you say, $2 trillion, whatever it was.
$6 trillion.
Whatever the number was, but the same sort of lie. Oh, people in the ghetto or someplace are now going to have, you know, 5 gig or something, whatever the hell it is. And by the way, they're all going to work and all going to pay so many taxes. We're going to be ahead on this deal too. Well, you put those two together, the two most buffoonish things together I've ever heard of, you know, and I think you're agreeing with me on at least one of them. And now today we have, without the war, we're talking $1 trillion every 100 days. And then we pop a war on top of it. You're right. If you just look at the war itself, you know, $100 billion is almost, unfortunately, rounding on the bottom line, right? But you know, where are we going with this? I mean, how much further? I mean, you're right. We haven't fallen off the cliff yet. But how high can you go? Can we go to a trillion every five days or 10 days? I mean, yeah, where can we go with this?
I mean, is the first cliff we're gonna run off Social Security? Because I think that's where.
No, I think the first cliff, especially if we have somebody who insults the people who loan us the money. Right now, the biggest moneymaker, I saw this YouTube thing. You know, you see this stuff, and you just, I don't really care what side or another I listen to, Lou. But no matter what side it is, despite their political leanings, they just might drop me a nugget of something that's actual fact, just might, that I could sit there and go, wait a minute, I didn't think of that. So there's this lady on there talking about Japan. Now, Japan has even worse. We owe, I think our GDP is something like 21 trillion, and our debt is like 39. Maybe it's 22 and 39. So we're not quite twice as much, which is worse than I think we've ever been, except for maybe the week after World War II. Japan is worse than that. They're like three times. So she's walking through the routine where, because the Japanese yen has dropped in relation to the dollar, oil going from 60 to 100 is really going from 60 to 130 for Japan, and how they import virtually all of it. Now, if they have fiscal problems to start with, this is going to cause even worse. And the only place they probably can go for cash is the $1 trillion that they have invested here. And she goes, nobody's thought about, what if these guys need $200 billion of that back? and by the way, the second now is Britain. And, you know, Trump does nothing but bitch about Britain. You just look at this all together, try and put it all together, it's a pretty sordid mess. And what I'm, if you tie it into, Lou, we're talking about the people that have wealth now generally have it. And how many people do you know in the last 30 years made 100 grand a year, lived on 70 frugally, and put 30 grand in the bank every year, and that's how they grew their wealth? Nobody. Maybe next to nobody. Everybody has a 401k, they bought some Apple stock, and now it went up, and it's changed their life, which is terrific. I mean, that's what I do for a living. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. But what I do know from the Vietnam era is if we go down that road and these long-term rates go from where we're pushing 5 on the 30-year, if that were to go to 9, because I lived through this, so did you. I had a house or a condo I was from remodeling and went from 8.5 to 14 in 6 months. What does the market look like? What do the housing prices look like? If all of them drop, if they all drop 30%, what does this country look like in terms of wealth, in terms of people's, is most of their wealth is in stock? What if Bitcoin drops another 50%?
Yeah. So here's the question, obviously, that I think I ask from a public policy perspective. My triple P. I keep using that alliterative phrase. Is this worth spending money on? We have to stop. We don't have a tax problem, from my perspective. We have a spending problem. So what are we spending money on? Are we spending money on?
Well, you think we don't have a tax problem, but
well, that's just my
opinion. But we do. I mean, let me put it this way. I don't want to pay a nickel more either, so I'm with you on that. But I think when Bush invaded Iraq, if he were to tell people, okay, to pay for this,
yes,
for the next 2 years, we're having a 25% surcharge.
Absolutely agree. And he was following the playbook that Johnson did for Vietnam, which was, we want to engage in this, we feel it's necessary, but we don't want to confront people with the price of our foreign policy decisions. I agree.
Well, but I want you to talk, but just remember one thing, everybody. If you go over what you take in as a government, there's only three things you can do to deal with it. One is to borrow it, and that's getting trickier. One is to tax it, and nobody, including me, wants to do that. The third is to print it. What's the easiest?
Yeah, the easiest is to print it because you have absolute control. So the question I've got for you, and this again, this goes back to fundamentals. What are we spending the money on? I always harken back to a great line from a guy named P.J. O'Rourke, who was this absolutely brilliant social commentator, wrote in the 80s and 90s. But he talked about being on a Navy ship and watching a Tomahawk. So this would have been in the 80s, late 80s. Watching a Tomahawk missile getting fired out of a destroyer, and just watching this thing tear off into the night, riding off on this trail of flame, and seeing it, you know, heading off into the distance and realizing that thing was gonna travel 1,500 miles on its own.
Wow, those guys, they can go that far? I didn't know. Well, that.
Oh yeah, the strategic ones can. This thing was going to go 1,500 miles and navigate its way all the way to the target and deliver a strike, you know, on behalf of the U.S. of A.
So you could fire one of those from Chicago and land it on Miami. I had no idea they went that far.
Oh yeah, the strategic
they don't go into orbit, do they?
No, they fly at 400 miles an hour.
Really?
30 feet off the deck.
Wow.
Yeah, and they're autonomous. They have terrain contour matching radar.
Are they rocket or what are they?
No, they're jet engines.
Okay.
Basically, I think they started with T-38 jet engines, but this thing's gonna go that far and it's gonna strike its target. And he said, you know, I look at that, and then I think we could spend, you know, all the people are screaming, we could spend money, all the money we're taking on defense, we could spend it on social welfare programs. He said, we do. We spend the money on a welfare program. We end up with dependency, you know, low marriage rates, you know, people, you know, rioting, etc. Versus watching this thing go off and strike a target somewhere. I'm going to vote for the guy for the thing striking the target, rather than spending the money on the social program, because that has a direct. I could see that it has a direct impact, a positive impact on the nation. Is this, you know, the guns and butter argument? I think is going to, maybe it's going to rear its head finally.
Well, it is,
directly.
It is,
but to spend this money on and I firmly believe that the attack on Iran was going to happen eventually, and I would much rather, as somebody said, it's 1936 all over again. I would much rather spend the money now on a way that, you know, allows us to do something like this, and I think it's absolutely necessary, that allows us to do something like this relatively cheaply versus having to spend 100 times that and at the cost of a lot more life.
You never know on that degree. In principle, I have no problem with it, to be honest with you. I would agree with you, which I'm not supposed to do in here, right? But the fact is, who's our moral compass? We've bombed 7 countries now in 13 months. I mean, you know, it's a, just because you don't like somebody doesn't give you a right to kill them.
Oh, I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue is it's not a question of like. We would have been perfectly happy to leave Iran alone, and we did.
Well, okay. I mean, they're tied into this thing with Israel,
didn't work. No, it didn't work.
All right, can I get back to what?
No, they're not tied in with Israel. They're tied in with this thing called radical Islam
that is
vehemently opposed
to what we
to
like
every yeah. Western cultural concept that you and I hold dear.
Well, I'm with you on that. Hey, just to go back to what you were talking about regarding guns versus butter again, and you know, I always try and. These principles, these discussions, Lou, somehow or another, they always change given the time. And I don't know why. You know, I guess as I've gotten older and studied this stuff more, even in school where they told you stuff that was supposed to be a principle, the question is the principles. What time are you talking about? Right. I mean, so when you talk about when you have to get back to our inflation argument. I believe, if I was going to be a preacher, that if you go back to when you and I were growing up, I got no problem with it. Because some guy got a job as an assistant manager at a Jewel. The guy could afford a bungalow. He could afford a Chevy pickup, or not a pickup, but a station wagon. If somebody had a baby, you could afford that in the hospital. Those kinds of things. But since then, that stuff has gone to the point where an incredible amount of your population can't do any of that anymore. I mean, regular people making $52,000 a year, which is the median, and they get hit with a $5,000 transmission bill. It's not like 1968. It's not like that. You're talking about the average person, even somebody who has a good job, doesn't piss away all his dough drinking or with drugs or anything like that, the chances of him being able to write a check for an emergency visit for his kid's broken leg and or sprained ankle in soccer, that's going to be a $6,000 bill. Why or how? We've gone so far beyond that this is no longer charity. Your people can't afford it. It's not the same as giving somebody money in 1968 because he refused to go to work. We're talking about now, the difference over the last 35 years is that the people that are, I'll use the term, poor or not doing as well, they're all working. Well, a lot of them are working. It's totally different. You and I can get a job for 45 grand and have to go to work every day. Every year we pay more for tolls. Every year we pay more for parking. We're lucky if we walk out of the place with 25. And we're talking a third of a cost of a car, for God's sake.
I'm going to leave it on that note because I'm over my time. Right. I will talk to you in 3 weeks, and let's hope that our situation
absolutely
is improved.
I hope whatever the skills that I think Trump does have, doing some negotiating stuff, go at it, buddy. Finish this one off, and I'm all for it. And by the way, your job is to get back to us healthy.
Oh, I'll be back. No problem.
Well, you don't want to be flying on a plane and have like the shuttle hit you.
I will leave you with Happy Easter and don't eat too many chocolate rabbits.
Oh, take care of yourself, bud. Jimmy, we have our guys.
Yes, we do.
By the way, well, we are down 109 points in the SPOOS and 507 in the NASDAQ. So all the good stuff we picked up the last couple of days, oot. So guys, are you short SPOOS?
Well, I've been short of a lot of things, but I don't think that it's one of them.
God, and I bet Andrew was sold right before the speech last night. He's a clever guy.
Well, he's got his contacts down at the White House.
So. Yeah. So he got the speech, and he ran and he sold spoon. He sold gold. He sold everything. Bought oil.
Well, good morning. It's each day or part of a day is an adventure in learning what our futures are. So,
well, my Andrew, you don't know the gospel of what you just said. We our protected index program here, which by the way we do manage money. If anybody's in trouble, you could give us a call. Our protected the idea is to buy put protection out further and sell calls if you want to. In closer, because the theory of there is, unlike auto insurance, options decay not with time. So in other words, if you wanted to pay for a year auto insurance versus 6 months, it might cost you a little less because they're only going to process it once, but basically it's double the price, right? But options don't decay like that. They decay with the square root of time. So the idea is to be protected where your time decay is a little bit, and the stuff you're selling against it, it's a little bit more, or more, a lot more. But now my brother and I, we constantly are having this, we always have a debate on every trade. That's the idea of having 2-3 people talk about it, right? And he said, well, should we go out a couple of weeks? And I go, Dan, every day is a week. I mean, he looks at me, and I'm the one who designed the system. I go, I know it's against everything we've ever done, but I don't need to go out 3 weeks. We're going to be rolling these things tomorrow. This has never happened before. I mean, every day now, like you say, is like a month. It's crazy, isn't it? Actually, every announcement from the White House, most of which are front run, is like a month, right?
Well, and for those in the prediction game, which I definitely try to stay away from, one of the lessons, I think, is humility, because it helps protect against a false sense that because we've seen and learned many things through the decades that we can predict what's going to happen tomorrow. And yet we've kind of got to in some ways. But it just makes sense to, I think, have that little birdie on the shoulder saying, we haven't got it figured out, and very few people have.
Well, I think you can figure out some stuff, and not always. Only because the three of us have been around for a while. I don't see how, you know, people can come on the air. You know, I've been studying this for a while. It doesn't make me that smart, because if I was that smart, I'd be able to tell you we'd be down today, we'd be long puts, and yesterday would be long calls. Well, but you know what? It's a lot harder than that. But the idea that we're going to continue borrowing more and more money and interest rates are not going to go up is somewhat insanity, because the first thing I think you guys, currency is a good like everything else. It derives its value from its scarcity. So if you put money in the system and you start borrowing money, people are going to demand a higher price for you to lend, for that you have to pay them for their dough. This went on in Vietnam. It went on sort of with the when Bush invaded Iraq. It never changes. It's so they have 7 to 10 people on a TV during the day saying the Fed's going to lower rates this year. How the hell are they going to do that with the amount of money that they're borrowing? I mean, I think you guys are sort of with me on this. This is starting to sound like Vietnam all over again to me.
Well, it is, but here's one thing you dealt with in the previous hour, but just to amplify on it, we assume that these countries like Japan and Germany and Britain, that they're going to keep supporting our currency and our debt, even as we insult them in a way that's never occurred before. I mean, it's a little before my time, but I read. I don't think Eisenhower was insulting Germany and Japan.
Andrew,
the war against them.
Andrew, take away the part where he's insulting him, because you and I both think that's kind of crazy. But put the part in there that if all of a sudden, you know, the strait stays closed and Trump withdraws and says it's your problem now, which is interesting, which is what he said last night, is Japan, even if there's, you know, they don't mind the insult about you had a sneak attack at Pearl Harbor, but even if they don't mind that, can they still throw $1.1 trillion our way because we need it?
I mean,
whether or not they like us or not, are they going to be able to?
Well, and also it's a society that's particularly attuned to disrespect and so forth. But yeah, putting that aside, can they do it if they've got a huge shock in their oil prices and energy costs? And you know, they're not one of the fortunate ones with a natural oil supply. So it may not even be sensibilities, as you point out. It could just be, what can they afford?
Well, the by the way, what is the money? I had the chart up yesterday. I could get it here. I think I probably could. The money that comes like from the Cayman Islands, there's like $560 billion that comes from it. Whose money is that that's invested here? Do you have any idea?
Well, all those offshore financial centers, the reason money is parked there is because they have these very strict business confidentiality and financial confidentiality rules. A lot of it is people who are evading taxes in their own country. Now, there's been a lot to try to crack down on it, but depending on what offshore a place you're talking about, for example, in the UK, well, it's not actually in the UK. There are three British islands: the Isle of Man, Guernsey, and Jersey in the Channel, English Channel. They have very strict confidentiality laws, and they also have a lot of tax evasion money there, but they are crown dependencies of not the UK, but of the British monarch. So they're kind of in this area of, well, you know, you know, you could talk to Prime Minister Starmer and say, you got to do something about the money that's parked there. You know, he'd say, well, I'm not the prime minister of those three islands. They've got their own chief ministers, and they report directly to now King Charles. So, you know, there's a lot of these conveniences. It's like, you know, flags of convenience that these ships, merchant ships fly. You know, there's a big problem with the Russian, what they call the ghost fleet. You know, the Russians, they're not flying a Russian flag, but they're owned by Russians. They're involved in smuggling oil, but they fly the flags of, like, the Marshall Islands or
Wayne, if you don't mind, educate me and maybe the rest of the listeners. What does it actually mean to fly somebody's flag? What does that even mean? Obviously they got the flag on the back of the boat, but does that mean, it doesn't mean the ship was built there. It doesn't mean the ownership's there. What does it mean?
No, and you're absolutely right. And the flag of convenience, the ship is registered in the country of which their flag is flying on their stern. The reason for this is these flag of convenience countries, they don't have any insurance regulators that go on and make sure that the ship is actually seaworthy or not. They avoid all kinds of safety issues. You know, the ownership could be through a sort of a weaving network of offshore entities. So you see a ship with oil that looks like a rust bucket flying the flag of, say, Hong Kong, which is one of the places the Russians are using right now. And it may have never been in the port of Hong Kong. It may have only ever traveled in the Atlantic.
So how do I even do it? So I go out and buy a tanker. Well, you know, why I would want to do that? I'd have to use your guys' money to do that. But I go out and buy a tanker, and I go, all right, I'm going to flag this in Hong Kong. What do I do? Go to the Hong Kong embassy? Do I have to drive the thing over there? I mean,
no, you don't even have to do that. All you got to do is register it with some Hong Kong regulator. And also, there's an international registry of ships. And you, of course, use some phony entity or brass plate operation to file ownership papers. But the reason these ships are used, well, one is, you look at the crews, for example, on some of these ships. They're from these, you know, very poor countries, the Philippines, African countries, places like that. But the ownership may be, you know, Russian or even a landlocked country.
I mean, really?
You're talking, yeah, like Belarus. They're landlocked, but you know they may be, you know, have their flag on these merchant ships. You can spot these. Of course, now we see that the NATO nations, if there still is a NATO, France and the UK and Germany are actually stopping these suspect merchant vessels, most of them oil tankers, for two reasons. One, they think they're smuggling oil because they're Russian owned, and there's also a belief that they're cutting these submarine cables in the Baltic and in the Norwegian and North Sea, using some sort of device, a submarine deployable device to actually slice through communications cables. So it's a big issue, these ships.
Well, yeah, I mean, it must be so complicated. I mean, so I buy a tanker before I drive it anywhere. I needed to get it flagged. I need to get somebody to insure it, right?
Yeah, you're gonna get some insurer who is, you know, gonna insure it for probably very little, because it's not really valuable. As a ship, what's valuable is the contraband it may be, you know, delivering to sanctioned countries. Now, it's interesting. So, you know, Trump had the Coast Guard and the military grab some of these ships in the Caribbean, the Atlantic. They were Russian owned, but they were involved in exporting Venezuelan crude. And then he put this embargo on Cuba. He just let one of these Russian flagged oil tankers dock in Havana. So, I mean, we're almost like in the same league as these countries like Russia and Belarus and others that are smuggling or involved at least in sanctioning smuggled oil and other products.
Yeah, we're becoming what we detest, right?
Yeah. So, you know, it's there's no. I mean, maybe the Russians put some money into Trump's bank account in Qatar, where you know he stuck some of the proceeds from the Venezuelan oil he seized. He put it in his own bank account over in Doha.
Well, just the complete or the zip we're doing earlier. Well, right now the major countries this is a 2026 are Japan, United Kingdom, China, mainland are down to 694. They were pushing it 900 and some, so they're down quite a bit. Belgium 451, Luxembourg 446, and the Cayman Islands are 432. I guess my question is, you guys know better. Maybe not anybody really knows who actually their bank accounts coming from the Cayman Islands. Whose money is it? Does anybody know? If it comes from Japan, it's the Japanese government, I think, and some of the bigger people. But and who the hell's the Cayman Islands? Is that Andrew's account, or what is it?
Well, remember there was this big leak of financial data from a law firm in Panama City, Panama. It was Mossack Fonseca. It was called the Panama Papers.
Okay.
And it was leaked by some group that got the whole nine yards. And there they were, all in the Cayman Islands, all these other places. You saw all these entities. They were owned by, very wealthy people, foreign heads of state. You got a lot of foreign heads of state and heads of government that are ripping off their own treasuries and putting the money in places like the Cayman Islands. Cayman Islands is sort of attractive like Bermuda is because it's part of the British, it's a British self-governing territory.
So if we flew down there and what we want, we have cash in our pocket? I mean, how do we open up an account in the Cayman Islands?
Well, yeah, you take a cashier's check, good for the amount of money. You wouldn't be taking a couple of suitcases full of it. That's pretty obvious. But you take a cashier's check down here, open up an account. But you can do this remotely as well. You don't have to go down there.
Could I pay my put my
remember Bernie Madoff was rolling his accounts in the Cayman Islands and Belize, this little country in Central America. I talked to one of his guys and he said, oh yeah, every afternoon Bernie would go into the unofficial part of Madoff Securities and say, okay, everybody, let's roll those accounts in the Caymans.
So, and let's not forget that was we mentioned on a previous show, but this is a golden oldie. That same guy that Wayne talked to up in New York said, yeah, every Friday he'd said, get me an inch of 50s.
Oh, God.
How much? Inch of 50s, yeah. I know.
How much,
that's
how much is
five
it?
Grand.
It's 5 grand?
Yeah, walking around money for the weekend for Bernie.
So if we paid Andrew for being on Stocks and Jocks, if we had dough, could we direct deposit at his Cayman account?
Oh, yeah, certainly. Certainly, yeah.
Well, let me provide some breadcrumbs that are out there for those who want to get into it, but like you, but a lot of the people who should get into it, they don't want to know. And here's a few of the breadcrumbs. First of all, for these Panama Papers, there is a group called the International Consortium of Journalists that somehow got their hands on this. And it's global journalists who want to find a way to get their story out, so they got a website, and it's a huge treasure trove of stuff. Well, it was about 8 or 9 years ago or more that they put it out. But two, there was a big whistleblower that Wayne and I have encountered of the UBS, United Bank of Switzerland, Brad Birkenfeld, and he thought that bankers like him were going to get into trouble. And he went to the Justice Department about 15 years ago with a list of 19,000 what he said were tax cheats using UBS. And he was he went to the Justice Department. He hired lawyers out of his own money to say, look, I want to be a whistleblower. He's the only one who is prosecuted. He went to jail, and his prosecutor was Alan Acosta, who gave the sweetheart deal to Epstein. And then...
And we know Epstein was involved in similar offshore...
Well, that's where I was going, that part of the interest, let's say, of some of us in the Epstein files is that it's at least as much about money laundering and insider trading as it is, well, maybe I shouldn't compare it to the perversion, the trafficking, but let's just say, without trying to balance those two scandals, that the Epstein files include a roadmap of precisely this kind of money laundering, insider trading, if people want to pursue it. But do what authorities want to pursue it? That's the question.
Well, you think Pam Bondi's going to pursue insider trading from the White House?
Well, the word is she may not have a job much longer.
Yeah, partly because she's trying to live on the knife edge of this, where she's part of, absolutely part of the cover-up, but she's become so visible on that she's likely to be ousted, just like Chrissy Noem was on the immigration. And that's another tale.
Oh, God. But you know what I've learned? You're right, Andrew.
That's had some interesting developments.
Oh, yeah. Well, you can't equate, you know, doing nasty stuff to a 14-year-old girl versus money. I mean, we're not going to go through that moral quagmire.
Yeah, I withdraw that.
Well, I mean, but I mean, we both.
They're both there.
But I think what I've learned from you two guys, and it's not. The 80% of, I think, the ongoing story is, you know, these people, the girls that were there, their life was never the same afterwards. So, I mean, it's a horrible situation. But I'm absolutely stunned by the fact that you guys bring up these names, and, you know, in the sense that it started way before Epstein and continues to go onward. And the whatever talent or connections he had in his money laundering sort of situation must have been so valuable that people were willing to go sit and have a beer with a registered sex offender to find out the information.
And also, if you're blackmailing important people,
well, that helps. That
who
helps.
Have money, you're going to use those illicit financial networks to get your blackmail money sent to you, or accounts in your or some entity you control their name. So there is a connection between the blackmail and these illicit, you know, financial networks.
Well, can you guys draw up, maybe Andrew, we're going to break in a little bit, but the connection between, we got 4 minutes. Lou talked, I think, before you guys were on the show, maybe when they first started the Ukraine thing. And they're having all these problems with, stuff and people. They put embargoes on Russia and this, that, and the other thing. So one of the things that they picked up in my feeble brain was they couldn't get roller bearings for their boxcars or train. Well, I know that if you can't get roller bearings, all of a sudden your trains don't go anywhere. And theirs are out in the middle of nowhere, and they don't have two tracks. So if one stops, they can't even pull it to the side because there is no side. So it's a big deal for them. Well, now here, this is 2-3 years later, and somehow or another, the Russians managed to get some roller bearings. Now, whether they've started making them, but I think it's, no matter what the embargo, no matter them being out of the, what's the money system? Not the safe, what's the SWIFT system? Is that the SWIFT system, guys?
Oh, that's Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Transfers, SWIFT. Their big North American gateway is in Culpeper, Virginia, which is...
Okay, theoretically, if somebody in Russia wants, you know, Timken roller bearings, I'm not supposed to be able to send them to them, and they're not supposed to be able to send me any money. Yet I think the three of us know that the people like Epstein and people around him can somehow make that happen. Is that a fair assessment? And that's why the people from Morgan Stanley and Cantor Fitzgerald all went to see the guy.
Yeah. Yeah, and these hedge funds, I mean, not only are they involved with them financially, but their bosses are named in these this disclosure of these Epstein files. These are big time people.
And to take a big picture of this, that something Wayne and I have, you know, tried to monitor for a decade or so. The conventional wisdom was, you know, he's a pervert. He's just hanging out at these nice places with the trafficking the girls and just living the life of leisure and perversion and horrible things. But we now see that he was working away at all kinds of things, you know, trying to get relatives of rich people into college or grad school and networking with college presidents and trying to get people cast in a Woody Allen movie and financing for Woody Allen movies. And it's like the reality was he was an extremely busy person.
He sounds like Trump.
On matters large and small, most of which were reprehensible.
Well, I brought this thing up for you, Andrew, so we have to break about all the people who we owe money to and what kind of condition they're in, national debt versus domestic product. I'll run through that after the break. But here's the kind of the moral question. And this is legit because I'm in a business like this, okay? I mean, PTI does not take payment for order flow. We try and hold our head above whatever, which means, you know, we can't give people free commissions. But we also talk to people and give advice and those kinds of things, and I think there's a... But I also know that over a period of time, that has cost us a lot of business, right? A real lot of business. To just do that kind of business, let people do it, get paid. We don't care if they lose or win. We don't give a crap. We don't do that. But I also know it's been very costly. Now, the Cantor Fitzgeralds of the world that really are people that have places all over the world and legitimately can move money from one place to the other, and Citigroup and places. If I want to buy, you know, railroad cars from some guy in Germany, they're going to ship the money over for me. You know, they're going to make it happen. They have a function. Well, if all of a sudden the people who cheat, like in our business, nobody spanks them. There's no thought that anybody would ever stop that. Like on the trading floor, if every time a broker left a, you know, with an order, five guys raced after him and did the trade before they got in the crowd, you get to the point where you can't do business legit because the enforcement isn't there. You have to, Cantor Fitzgerald has to talk to him. Because him and people like him are really doing what Cantor Fitzgerald is supposed to do straight, to the point where you can't be out of the loop and say you're an international money trader. I mean, are we reaching, I guess, so you guys can chew on that. Andrew likes to talk about these moral, you know, I think we've sort of reached that stage, and that's why they were there. I don't think the people from Cantor Fitzgerald, you know, said, you know, hold me, give me a minute, I'm going to the men's room, and oh, by the way, I'm going to mess with some 14-year-old on the way. I really don't think that happened. They had to be there for other reasons. Like S&P futures down 100, 100 exactly. NASDAQ futures down 470. Be right back with the horrible news across the board here. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some may be embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here.
We're back. Well, and welcome back, Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howe. Jim Lawler on the board. S&P futures down 100. NASDAQ futures down 463. I have just about every stock on the board here is red except for Chevron. Go figure that, Jimmy, huh? And then the Dow and so forth. I've got long-term rates are up. 10 years up 35 basis points. 30 years, 4.94. Why don't you do a quick traffic, weather, sports real quick, and then I'll do the let's do this first. Over in Europe, these guys are all up yesterday. The DAX down 596 today. It's 2.6%. FTSE down 72. Not much there. That's only 0.7. CAC around down 123, 1.6. So those guys are down some over there. But Nikkei down 1,200, 2.4%. Hang Seng down 177. Again, that's not horrible either. It's 0.7. Same thing with Shanghai, now 29.7. The bonds I just gave, oil up to the moon, Alice, up 937, 109.49, and that's us. Our stuff is actually going past Brent today. And we're going to get Wayne and Andrew's thoughts on that. I don't know why that is. Natural gas, 2.83. RBOB up 20 cents, 329, so get ready at the pump. Gold down 158, ouch, 46.38. Silver down $5. That's almost 7%. Foreign exchange, I have to believe the dollar is stronger. The dollar is gaining. The euro is down to 115.2. British pound down to 132. Crypto, ouch on the crypto as well, down 2,066.089. Jimmy, quick traffic, weather, sports. Cubs win.
Cubs did win. And traffic on the inbound Kennedy right now to the Jane Byrne Interchange. It is 23 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lake Cook to the Jane Byrne is 38. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolf to I-90 is 36. And the inbound Dan Ryan is 29. In Phoenix, it will be a high of 87. It is currently 67. And it will be clear and mostly sunny. Now for Chicago. We have a wind advisory. We have a few thunderstorms that could come in periodically through the day, a high of 68. And right now we're at 41. And you are right, the Cubs did win, and the official, what SWIFT does really mean, is Society of Worldwide Interbanking Financial Telecommunications.
There you go. Telecommunications,
also,
I like that.
Chief, a long time ago when I was at Citibank and we had our anti-laundering policy, one of the few countries you can bring a lot of cash with no questions is the Cayman Islands. The other one is Mexico. Most other countries will ask you at least some questions. They won't.
That means we need to get a lot of cash.
That means that they have no financial regulatory agreement with the United States at all, so they can do whatever they want.
Well, there you go. Guys, we've talked a little bit, and I want Andrew's... well, first of all, real quick, because I got this thing up here. U.S. is national debt's $39 trillion, GDP's 31. So we're, 30% over. China is 19, GDP 21 national debt, so probably not as bad as us. I don't believe those numbers. Japan, however, 4.4 in the GDP, 11.1 in the national debt. That's what I was talking about, Andrew and Wayne, about how got to make sure our guys. UK, which is our second biggest supporter, 3.9 on the national on the GDP, 4.5 in the national debt. So, in France, same way, 3.4 and 4.4. So I guess it's not so much whether they like us; it's whether they sort of could. But if you had to guess, kind of flipping back to the Epstein things, going all over the place as I usually do, I'm going to say some of these people that met him for some of these other reasons. I would say that if we met the guy somewhere, to have all these inroads every place, I'll bet he was amazingly engaging. And if you talked to the guy 10 times, you would say, man, I didn't realize he was such a pervert. He was always nice to me. Am I right on this? I mean, he couldn't have been a horse's ass to people, or he wouldn't have all these people, even though he obviously could benefit them, either sexually or with money. Generally, it seemed like the guy always had people around him, didn't he?
Well, exactly. And some of the people who are identified with him may have been there to add legitimacy to his operation. So, for example, the fact that somebody's mentioned as being with him, that could just be to add to legitimacy. So, you know, he wanted an office at Harvard or something. That doesn't mean that he was specifically targeting Harvard students. It's to drape himself in a comfort level of if Harvard or these politicians or these scientists like him, he must be okay, and falsely accused type of veneer that most people don't want to penetrate.
Is that the reason why you and I bring Wayne on with us, so it gives us a legitimacy?
That's right.
I won't touch
by
that.
By the way, there's a there's a guy who goes by the name Palm Beach Pete, who he amazingly looks like Epstein, and he drives around Palm Beach in a convertible, and people say, hey, I mean, he is a spitting image of Epstein. And now he's doing videos where he's giving people, he's doing, discourses on science and physics. These are areas, of course, the real Epstein wasn't interested in, and managed to rope in a lot of people, including Stephen Hawking. But, there's all these reports that... Oh, Epstein didn't die in a prison cell. He's around somewhere, and now this guy pops up, and he's driving around Palm Beach, which is all billionaires, of course. This guy's got to have some money himself, and people, they're waving to him and getting selfies with him. So yeah, even after he's dead, an Epstein lookalike can draw all this attention.
Well, about 3 years ago, some woman started showing up at Mar-a-Lago, and she had the name Rothschild, and she let it be known she was part of the Rothschild family. And of course, she was just a complete phony, and people were just, they thought, oh, she must be part of the banking family. And so she got these pictures taken. I'm not sure she played golf with our president, but and maybe he was former between presidencies. But she was she was a complete imposter, but she was making it work for a while for nefarious purposes, I'm sure.
Well, how if you had a guess, there's all kinds of rumors, innuendo, depending on which side you're on. And, you know, Trump's relationship with Russia, since he spent so much time there in the 80s, and do they have something on him? Do they not? I mean, who the hell knows, depending on who you listen to. But it seems like for a country that's supposed to have this, you know, massive, can't get money from anybody, can't get this and that, they seem to be doing okay. I mean, where is it total lack of enforcement on the holes? Are people dragging cash across the border? I mean, what did, you know, I would never do it, but I'm absolutely so intrigued by what could Epstein do that Cantor Fitzgerald and Goldman Sachs couldn't do? I mean, what routes did he have? Does that make me nuts to be curious about this, Andrew? Or it's just amazing to me how people always.
Well,
find
I think. But yeah, I think he used the companies. No, not Cantor Fitzgerald. I haven't read that, but Apollo Global Management and some of these others to do exactly, you know, the same thing, move money for him. And look at the guy. One of the guys that's really implicated in this Epstein scandal is this guy Staley, who was a big wheel at Barclays Bank. So he used actual financial establishments to move some of this money. It's interesting. Just in the last week, Hegseth apparently was buying wanted to purchase a bunch of defense related stock before we went into Iran, and whatever company, I forget the company, but they flagged it as suspicious and said, look, we don't want to get in trouble here. And
it was BlackRock.
Of course, nothing will happen to Hegseth.
No, it was BlackRock. Huh? BlackRock, I think.
Flagged That's it. Right. You're right. Yeah. It was BlackRock, right. So maybe they got some religion, so to speak, and, you know, over these, especially the Epstein thing, and say, hey, look, we don't want this on our... we don't want this on our...
You guys...
rap sheet.
Well, they're not... Most of them have retired, but they... Plus, they weren't working at the Fed forever, but I used to hang out with all these Fed guys. And those guys will tell you that you can't get a penny out of the place without somebody knowing about it if you're wiring money back and forth. I have no idea how I would get, you know, $2 million to rush you to buy something. I mean,
here's an explanation. Yeah. The more strict enforcement is for most people, then the higher the profits are for the insiders who know how to avoid the enforcement. Right?
Well, I would. Oh, sure. Well, it's like drugs. The less there are, the higher price goes up. Right?
Yeah. So it's great to enforce regulations against companies like yours.
Yeah.
Because that makes it for the real insiders, Epstein, who, you know, bluntly speaking, I think Wayne and I look on him more as a cog in a larger machine than an isolated pervert.
Well, I am, I do too. You guys have got me there. Go ahead.
And the machine, the insiders on this machine, they love it when there's tough enforcement against everybody else.
Well, I mean, guy.
Now there's a question. I was just going to say there's questions now being raised about Robert Maxwell, Ghislaine's father, and Donald Barr, William Barr's father, because he was ex-OSS. Robert Maxwell was MI6 in World War II. Donald Barr was OSS during World War II. Yet they converge where, you know, Donald Barr hires Epstein without a degree as a math teacher at the Dalton School. he is integrated in with the Robert Maxwell operation, which is very similar, not maybe as large as the one that Epstein he handed off to Epstein later, of course.
Well, who's the guy? The stuff you guys sent me about Epstein. They were talking about he worked for the guy Barr's father in the school, and he worked for what was the name of the firm? It wasn't Bear Stearns. Who the hell? He worked for somebody.
I think it was Bear Stearns.
Well, but then they said
one of his students. But then he the Dalton School. worked for Bear Stearns and brought in Epstein.
But there, in one of the articles you guys sent me, it said he learned the money laundering part from this guy like Pierce. Or, who's he? I never heard that name other than the one article you guys sent me. It said he learned. Why is this? You guys got to, next time you see me, kick me. Somehow or another, it just boggles the mind that if, I'll go back to my roller bearing stuff, if Russia needs roller bearings and they're nobody supposed to send it to them and nobody can get money from them, that you can go to this guy, oh man, just load up a train with three boxcars of roller bearings, ship the train down to Mexico to this port. I got a freighter down there, we'll put it on there, and 6 weeks from now I'll hand you a check. It boggles my mind how somebody can friggin' do that when everybody else goes, yeah, I can't do that. Isn't it stunning?
Yeah, you know, it reminds me of when I was in the Soviet Union back in 1990. I asked this guy, he said something about them having a digital equipment corporation, VAX 11780 mainframe computer. I knew that was on the embargo list for the Soviet Union. I said, hey, how the hell did you get one of those? And the guy, you know, they're all half drunk when you talk to these guys. And he says, well, you know, we found out that there's a country, Swaziland in Africa, that's not subject to the embargo against the Soviets, which is very similar to Switzerland. So we ordered it through Swaziland, and then we, you know, after it was in shipment, they said, oh, there's been a mistake. It's supposed to go to Switzerland, but it had already been approved for export to Swaziland. So it was able to be sent to the Soviet Union.
Well, with all Trump's amazing bluster on this stuff, it seems like the Russians can do kind of whatever they want. In terms of money, they don't seem to be... They're buying stuff from people. I mean, it appears. They're bartering it for oil, which is possible, I guess. But what do you make of... today the market's, you know, looks horrible, but it's had two good days in a row, so we're just kind of up and down. But this, I hope you guys can talk me out of this, as we sink deeper into debt and the interest rates go up, that we're looking at a 10-year market doesn't move like we did from 72 to 82. We're not going to do that again, are we?
Well, it's hard to know, but let's not move on too quickly from what's happening in the markets today and the most likely explanation, because the future is comprised of many presents. And not Christmas type presents, but it appears that the global markets took the downturn when people started realizing that Trump's speech last night did not have a solution, and that he's got a big speech here of what we've accomplished, what we're doing, but what people wanted to hear, and I think it's why the markets went up in various ways in the last 2 days before starting the downturn, is people thought, well, he's going to announce either some deal or some exit to bring this to a conclusion soon. And instead, we have the same almost contradictory mix of, well, we're working on a deal, but we're going to bomb the hell out of them, which, where does that lead? And so to solve the long-term problems, you got to address the short-term problems, which is a war that at least some people, like Paul Krugman and others, say, hey, we started a war against a fourth-rate military entity, and yeah, we're bombing and killing, but we're losing. Now, that's a bit of a controversial thesis, but whether we're losing or just bombing, what hope does that have for markets in the short run?
Well, our body counters always had a hell of a lot more of those guys dying than us in Vietnam. I'm not saying we won there. Would you?
No. And ultimately, they became a trading partner and ally after we got done with it. And by the way, here's a kind of controversial thesis, but I think it's true. I think JFK was on the way to ending it. He had to take gradual steps. If you look at in depth at the historical record in 1963, he was curtailing it because he had long been an opponent of what we were doing in Vietnam, but he kind of had to go along with the authorities at the time. But so we got to try to learn from these.
Well, how hard is it to shut off, you know, the CIA and the military? I mean, I'm not so sure. I didn't see the remake of the movie The Day of the Jackal. I don't know if you guys did or not, but the first one was really good. I thought the book was really good.
I think that's one where they should never do sequels for some movies, because it's the original that's the best.
Well, to get back to your question and kind of tee it up for Wayne, who worked in Navy intelligence and for a time for the NSA, I'm not sure that if you take the core of the CIA and our intelligence committee community, that they're in favor of this. And again, Wayne's a veteran of this community, but we can ascribe many mistaken judgments to the CIA and the intelligence community, but I think if you listen to them on the current issue, most of them, or many of them, and I attend meetings at George Mason University where a lot of prominent leaders speak, like General Hayden, who was once head of the CIA and the NSA, and I think they're skeptical, to put it mildly, about this, but again, Wayne's
Well, we had an intelligence sharing relationship for many years called Five Eyes. It's U.S., U.K., Australia, Canada, and New Zealand. And from what I'm gathering from what's coming out of the retired intelligence community people is that these other countries have cut us off completely with their intelligence, because they're afraid that it winds up in Russia.
Really?
That's a sad commentary about a network. Now, there's been abuses of it over the years. I've written about those, but we took more out of those other countries than we gave back. That was one of the criticisms from them. But to cut us off completely, because you're afraid this stuff is going to wind up in Russia is unbelievable.
And here's what the danger is. Let's make it practical. And this goes to, let's say, some of the papers that Trump took down to Mar-a-Lago that became the basis for the Jack Smith indictment. Taking it from abstractions, we have spies who, let's say, might be Russians in Russia or in other countries who are basically providing us information at the risk of their lives. And if their identities are known, they're dead.
Oh, right. I absolutely agree with that.
And that's happened, by the way, through the years. And so a lot of these people, both who are spies, but even in the world of Maxwell and Epstein, are living on a knife edge where, yes, they're getting rich and famous and all kinds of other things that they can buy, but they know that their lives are at risk. And in those cases, both Epstein and Maxwell, Robert Maxwell, they ended up very dead under very suspicious circumstances. So there's it doesn't take much to imagine consequences.
Andrew,
the
CIA
used to call that termination with extreme prejudice. They don't want to say assassination.
Andrew, when you mentioned that, and I was talking about the CIA in terms of Kennedy, I was not going to make the jump to right now. I agree that right now, but my point is comparison to the Day of the Jackal is when you're in Vietnam for a while, or in Afghanistan for a while, or in Iraq for a while, you end up with an awful lot of people that all of a sudden are making an awful lot of money by being there, whether it's the CIA gathering, you know, cocaine from the plants in Afghanistan, or wherever the drugs they come out of there, is it the heroin, whatever it is, whether it's something,
opium.
All of a sudden opium. There's people in Vietnam that are making more money than they ever dreamed about. So we're not there yet in this Iran thing, I don't believe. So I think you're absolutely 100% correct. But I think Kennedy had to fight those people to say, we're not going any further, and basically cut off their spigot, which is really what happened in the Day of the Jackal. The book was all about the reason why all these people wanted to assassinate de Gaulle was he disbanded the French Foreign Legion. And the French
foreign pulled gave Algeria independence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the people over there had fat and happy lives making a lot of dough out of Algeria. And all of a sudden he goes, you know, that game's over. Come on back to France and get like a real job. Well, that went over like a fart in church, right? I mean, to those guys.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, once you get involved.
Way,
in, go ahead.
One of those guys was the father of this leader of the right wing party, Le Pen. Le Pen, he died within the last few years, but he was one of the big wheels in Algeria that was obviously part of the let's get rid of de Gaulle operation.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think there's any question in my opinion, that Trump is a closet colonist. I mean, if I don't like the place, there's no doubt about that, and I don't know that. I mean, last night, all he did was talk about his tremendous victory in Venezuela. I mean, you listen to this and you wonder, but he keeps talking about the no inflation, and that's kind of my area. I don't think anybody's believing that. I don't know what. So what's going on between him and the Republicans in Congress and all that stuff between now and November has to be. We might be running over, but I got to ask you this question: what is the deal with the executive order that if you want a mail-in ballot, you got to run it by ICE?
Well, it's obviously unconstitutional, but he throws it up against the wall and creates doubt. And part of it is to discourage opponents from organizing or contributing, and that's got to be resisted, I think, as an advocate or analyst here, because the order, it's impractical, it's also illegal, but it has a purpose, which is discourage the opposition from doing normal political things out of fear that it'll be pointless because the all-powerful president will control the elections.
Well, I'll lob this one at you guys just in finality here, although you can surely comment on it. The thought crossed my mind that when he did that, and now my brother votes by mail, and a lot of people, I don't, because the polling place is literally four houses down from in a little park by me. So, I mean, the idea of going somewhere else to vote would be pretty ignorant on my part, but or even doing the mail thing. But it struck me, as everybody even here in the office, we don't have that many people, everybody's polling place except mine seems to have changed. So if, even with this thing, even by lobbing it out there, even if it's not true, if all of a sudden all the people who now intend to vote by mail say, look, we can't stand this guy, we're going to go vote against him, we're going to go back to our polling place, I don't think you can. I have a number here, and you guys can kick me from afar. Since between 2012 and 2022, 27,000 polling places have closed in this country.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that in some states, I mean, Colorado was big on this, Lou always votes by mail. I don't think that in one day, if everybody said, I don't want Trump's goons looking at me, if everybody decided to go to the polling place, I don't think they could do it.
Well, exactly. And one of the things we've seen in places like Atlanta and Georgia is the state legislature reduces the number of polling places in a city. That makes it really inconvenient for people to show up at the polls, particularly if they show up, they wait online, and then they find it's not the right polling place, and it's to discourage the vote. And people have to know what's coming in advance and say and make a decision, no, this is important, to figure it out and not just show up and learn that I can't do it.
Well, Trump, and I would never once underestimate his ability to read the dark side of people, because he's fantastic at it. I mean, you guys even have to admit to that, I think.
Well, it's not just him. It's a whole apparatus.
Right.
Because he's not paying that much attention to this.
Well, what I'm saying is the I talked to my brother yesterday, of course, and a couple other guys that I had a cocktail with. We, like you, Andrew, are South Side guys. Give us a challenge, we're ready for it, right? Now, you know, I mean, in my world, if this bastard doesn't want me to vote and he's going to make it hard for me to vote, I don't care if I have to drive to Idaho to vote, I'm going to do it. His read of people is, if you make it slightly less convenient and you give anybody any thought that you're going to run their name through the masked goon, they're not going to vote. Now, the question is, who's right? So far, he's been right and you and I have been wrong. Is he going to be right this time?
I would just say, keep an eye on the April 12th Hungarian election, because the polls are overwhelmingly against Orban. He has effectively rigged his system over there, but if they have enough of a turnout, they got the same issues we have, that he may be defeated. If he wins with these overwhelming polls against him, just like we have here in this country with Trump, I say, you know, Katie bar the door. Because all these people like Orban and Trump are matching notes.
And last quick thing, we're actually campaigning for the dictator. Is it J.D. Vance who's over there campaigning?
That's unbelievable. Well, is J.D. Vance a plus or a minus for the guys?
It's a question.
Yeah.
Get him around any couch. Around any couches.
What are you guys doing for Easter? Anything special?
Well, I'm going to be going up to my sister's. She puts on an Easter dinner spread every year, and
something like that for me.
Wayne, are we going to
the best?
Wayne, are we going to go to when you come to Chicago? Are we going to go see the Village of Oak Lawn and try and get a Andrew Craig Memorial Street sign where he was born?
Yeah, I think we should. Yeah, we should do that. I mean, there is a Paul Harvey street up there. I think the Miracle Mile.
Well, no, they're tearing down. What's his name? Who's the guy that was the farm workers, migrant union guy?
Chavez.
Yeah, I think they're pulling his street site down over in Pilsen.
Well, they can't tear down my memorial until they build it. So
good point. Anyway, guys, talk at you next week. Let's hope this craziness comes back a little bit, and I sure would like some peace over there. I don't like the idea of leaving the strait closed for all the other guys to go open it. That's kind of you break it, you own it. It's kind of the opposite of that, eh? I broke it, you own it. It's kind of a different world. But anyway, S&P futures down 96, NASDAQ futures down 457. We've not come back at all here. Interesting to see what happens today, the last day. No show tomorrow. It's Good Friday. Back on Monday, and we're going to have Carl on Monday, because tomorrow morning we're having a labor report. So the first 15, 20 minutes, maybe more, half hour on Monday, we're going to go through our normal Friday labor report. That'll be an interesting number tomorrow, guys. We'll talk about that next week. Thank you, Jimmy. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
This is Bob Uecker saying thanks for watching.
Hear that one? It's 27,000 polling.